From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, debate at the Capitol over adding LGBT protections to the state's Civil Rights Act.
There's really a schism here and a divide on whether this is needed.
Then, a month after November's big Democratic losses, party leaders and strategists are trying to figure out how to rebuild their base.
This is the electorate we've got, and we've got to talk to that electorate in a way that appeals to them.
And Brady Hoke is now the former football coach for the University of Michigan. How did it all go down?
It could not have been handled better, more professionally, more respectfully to Brady Hoke and the players. I thought they nailed it.
Plus, a rise in celebrity winemaking.
The Jerry Garcia Grateful Dead wines. The Olivia Newton-John wine.
But are they any good? Those stories and more. The future of the Democratic Party in Michigan. A month after big losses on Election Day, what comes next?
Democrats have to be bolder.
Can party leaders and strategists get Democrats to fall in love again?
I think we have a credibility problem.
I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty, from blue state to red state and back again. Then the rise of celebrity wines. One reviewer says they're not all that good. So the question is, why are people actually buying them? But first, right now in Michigan, you can be fired from a job or be denied housing if you're gay. A group of LGBT rights advocates wants that changed. This morning, a state House committee heard debate over adding LGBT protections to the state's Civil Rights Act. Detroit News Capitol reporter Chad Livengood was at the hearing. Hey, Chad.
Hi, Zoe. How are you this afternoon?
Good. So what did we hear at the hearing today?
Well, we heard testimony both from Representative Frank Foster and Representative Sam Singh, who've got competing bills for expanding Elliot Larson's Civil Rights Act. Representative Foster, the chairman of this Commerce Committee, has a bill that includes sexual orientation in the list of protected classes under the Civil Rights Law. And Representative Singh has sexual orientation and gender identity or expression. And that the last three words there are kind of crucial to the LGBT community so they can get protections for transgender individuals. But there's really a schism here and a divide on whether this is needed. Representative Foster says that transgender individuals are already covered under the definition of sex. Many of the advocates for this bill say that that's not the case and that these folks will be just left out of the protection that is afforded for housing and employment and public accommodations.
Right. And we saw this right before lawmakers went on their Thanksgiving break, the sort of breakdown between supporters of sexual orientation and gender identity and just sexual orientation. Is there a sense at the Capitol which way groups are leaning?
The groups that are supporting this, the business coalition of major corporations from Whirlpool to Steelcase to various universities, they are opposed to just the two-word addition, just doing sexual orientation. They would, frankly, rather torpedo the bill and not allow it to be passed. And Democrats, House Democrats in particular, essentially are not going to vote for the Frank Foster bill as it stands right now. But at the same time, Frank Foster can't get enough votes to get the Singh bill out of committee. Although Representative Sam Singh from East Lansing says he's got plenty of votes. He's got 51 co-sponsors as it is right now.
Right.
And if he can just find five Republicans, which he probably can find, he can get this thing passed out of the House of Representatives. So it is kind of coming down to there is a bit of a stalemate on this issue on how to proceed. And the other problem with Sam Singh's bill is Speaker Jay Spolger has made it clear he's opposed to that bill. They call it the five-word bill.
Right. And of course, Speaker Bulger has a lot of power in Lansing. We have seen him be able to torpedo things in the past. What are we looking at from him?
Well, look, he's the outgoing Speaker of the House. He does set the agenda and wields the gavel here and can make things move and make things die. So at the same time, the LGBT community is sort of making a pretty fervent stand here that That there, you know, that the legislature needs to do this to make Michigan look more of an inclusive state and more welcoming and opening to all people. At the same time, they're not going to settle for a law that essentially keeps one class of folks in their community not protected. And so they're really kind of going to the mat here on this. At the end of the day, if they don't get what they want here and this thing all kind of melts down, they have vowed to try to go to the ballot and take this to the people in 2016, that which also could, you know, could come along with the other issue of same-sex marriage if the Supreme Court doesn't settle that their way.
Right, of course. And then meantime, you have Governor Snyder, in addition to all of this, who called on the legislature to take it up and debate it back in May on Mackinac Island, and yet he has not said whether he would sign it or not.
Yeah, he has really kind of provided like tepid support for having a debate, but has not really thrown all his weight behind it, which is kind of surprising given all the business bigwigs,
sure,
Herman Miller and such, who have endorsed this and are pushing for it actively. We did hear some testimony today from opponents, from labor attorneys who represent businesses who think that this will create a minefield of new laws, discrimination lawsuits, and also from Keith Den Hollander, the chairman of the Christian Coalition of Michigan. We don't see in front of the legislature very often testifying on bills, and he was questioning, well, where are the mass firings of gays and lesbians? So why don't we hear about these stories? And some of those stories just don't ever get told publicly, and that's probably why. But so he was trying to sort of pour some cold water, so to speak, on the need for this bill and push back at it.
Detroit News Capitol reporter Chad Livengood at a hearing this morning about adding LGBT rights to the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Zoe.
To many, yesterday's firing of University of Michigan football coach Brady Hoke came as no surprise. That includes Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Hey, Bacon.
Hello, Zoe.
Break down for us just what happened in the past few days that led to this decision.
The season ended on Saturday with another loss to Ohio State. They played actually pretty valiantly. The last 2 years, their best games were against Ohio State, both losses. But then Sunday, of course, he talks to Jim Hackett, that is, the interim AD, soon, I believe, to be the permanent AD. Talks to President Schlissel about it. Then he calls Brady Hoke, so he knows what the deal is. Monday, Brady's got to face the Weber's crowd anyway, which is the Monday afternoon press conference. Tuesday, wanted him to have time to have his regularly scheduled meeting with the team, which you always have 2 days after the season ends, 3 days after, I should say. And then here we are.
How was this handled? I mean, we've talked before with you about how things at the university, the program, have been handled. How was this firing from your perspective?
It could not have been handled better, more professionally, more respectfully to Brady Hoke and the players. I thought they nailed it. If you have to do this, this is how you do it. And Jim Hackett had a lot of nice things to say about Brady Hoke, which were true. He was also refreshingly direct as to why he was letting Brady Hoke go. He said, look, the values were great. The players loved him. He was doing things the right way in the classroom and the community and so on. His players certainly were. But it's Michigan, and the success was not there, and it wasn't.
Let's talk a little money. There's a large severance package.
There always is these days, Zoe.
Sports, after
as,
all.
As a University of Michigan employee, you don't want to know what just happened there.
Well, tell us, for those of us who like a little pain,
You asked, Zoe. Lloyd Carr received around $1 million, more or less, per year as Michigan's head coach at the end. Rich Rodriguez got $2.5 million. Brady Hoke jumps to $4 million per season. That's 4 years. So there's right there, $16 million, of course. And then he gets a $3 million severance package. That's a total of $19 million. Now, look, it is always sad to see a man's dream job become a nightmare, and that's what happened here, of course. It's not fun to watch, and only the most evil will take pleasure in a man's demise. But it's hard to feel too sorry for a man who failed at $19 million for 4 years. So that's hitting the jackpot.
So, John, you know, some have raised this question about having an interim AD choosing a new football coach. Is there a problem in your mind?
There could be, and we're about to find out if there is or isn't. The problem is you have no experience doing this, whereas a professional athletic director, a guy like Brad Bates at Boston College or Ward Manuel at UConn, names that have come up before, of course, on this show, they have been around these searches for 20, 30 years. They know how they work. They've done them themselves many times for big and small jobs, field hockey or basketball or football. Jimmy Hackett has never hired anybody in this regard, probably not even an employee yet,
right,
in the department. So now you have to pick pretty much the most important hire of Michigan Athletics for the next decade, at least, really. So that is a lot of pressure without much experience. You will, he said today, he's bringing in a search firm, so that will certainly help. He will have to rely on some people who know more than he does.
Are there names that are being floated around?
The same ones. Jim Harbaugh, my old squirt hockey teammate. Actually, we're teammates in Bantam, I think, but whatever. I have to go look that one up.
I was going to say, now we need to know this.
I was very short then, so I don't remember. Even shorter. He was still tall. But one of us is a sports writer. One of us is a professional football coach, so go figure on that one. But anyway, Jim Harbaugh is name 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
And he's raised in Ann Arbor, Michigan's ball boy, believe it or not, in the 70s for Rick Leach, the quarterback. His dad was a coach at Michigan, Jack Harbaugh.
I didn't know that.
Under Bo Schembechler. How about that? So this guy's roots go very, very deep. And he has expressed privately some interest in this. Now, how much remains to be seen? I've got to believe he's Michigan's number 1, 2, and 3 choices. He done a great job in San Francisco and at Stanford, which will impress Mark Schlissel, who is putting academics first, of course, as he should. And if you can win at Stanford with 23 engineers on your roster, and they were a top 10 team when Michigan was not, with fewer than 23 engineers on their roster, then that's pretty impressive. He's the first choice. Second choice might be, we're not sure, Les Miles. But in the fans' eyes, that's probably the case. He played and coached with Michigan at Michigan for Bo Schembechler and others.
Of course.
He's now at LSU, won a national title there. Their pedigree is very strong. There are some folks in Ann Arbor who aren't as fond of him, former coaches, that is, Lloyd Carr, and Les Miles do not get along. So that's item two. Item three is everybody else in the world, possibly including you and me.
I've already had my interview.
Damn it. I knew it, man. That is a job, by the way. I will neither accept the nomination. I'm not seeking nor will accept the nomination.
Not even one that it's like an honor to be nominated?
$6 million, I still don't want that job, trust me.
$19 million?
Keep talking. we're getting warmer.
John U. Bacon is Michigan radio sports commentator. John, quite a past 2 days for you. Thanks so much.
Oh, the more is coming. I guarantee you that.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. There is a rise in celebrity winemaking and naming wine after celebrities. There's the Fergalicious bottle, for example. That's after singer Fergie. And there's rapper Lil Jon, who started Little Jonathan Winery. And, of course, Michigan's own Madonna, whose family owns the Ciccone Vineyard up north. But the real question is why, and who's actually buying these bottles?
I think what we're seeing is a little bit more of a push in this area than we've seen before. It's not that there haven't been celebrity wines around. It's that I think the marketing guys have gotten a hold of it, and they're looking for broadening this niche somehow.
Chris Cook is chief wine and food critic at Our Detroit Magazine.
I've noticed a lot more of it, and I've not just here. There's a lot of stuff that we don't see here. That has celebrity names on it, and some of them are kind of a little funny.
Right. So this is more about branding than actual taste?
Well, yes, but, you can't downgrade the taste issue totally, certainly. I think that the emphasis in this, what it says, is it's more on the name that's on the bottle than it does than what's in the bottle. Now, having said that, even Marilyn Merlot is, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just... Are there better Merlots? Well, yeah, there are.
So then why are people buying them?
Well, because I think there's a lot of novelty to it. One of the things that the wine industry is very interested in doing is hitting that younger niche market. And so where you have celebrity names, there's a lot of sports guys with their names on wines.
Really? Like what?
Oh, well, you got Wayne Gretzky has a wine up in in Canada. It's not seen here. Mario Andretti has had a line for years. I mean, a little WD-40 in the old in the old wing of the wine doesn't hurt too much, I guess. Tom Seaver was another one, but there are a lot of these guys out there. And then you have the artists, the rock stars and the movie stars.
Right, so. The Fergalicious bottle, Lil Jon, as I mentioned. So that seems maybe to be sort of for the younger drinkers.
Well, yes, that is the younger. That follows the Jerry Garcia Grateful Dead wines and the Olivia Newton-John wines from Australia.
These are just so bad.
And there was one named also, I don't know if it's still around, for Neil Diamond, and the one for Barbara Streisand, and there was a Bob Dylan involvement in some wine at one point.
So maybe the real question is, what celebrity doesn't have a wine?
Gosh, I wouldn't want to try to make a list of that. But, you know, our most notable wine was an Elvis Presley wine.
You write about that, in fact, in this month's Our Detroit magazine, The Always Elvis. And it's quite the story.
It is. Well, you know, let's put Elvis in perspective here. There's probably more wines been named after Elvis than anybody else. I mean, there's been a Blue Suede Shoes. But Always Elvis goes back to the 1970s. And it was the idea, apparently, of a marketing guy somewhere in the Detroit area. And they imported the most awful Moscato that you could get in Italy in the 1970s and put it in this bottle. And this was like the year after Elvis died. This is, apparently is the same company that made something called Wolverine wine. So if you can imagine, you know, the interior smell of a football helmet, you know, adds a little to wine there. So Elvis, Always Elvis is around. It's now kind of becoming this cult thing. I've seen it online on eBay. You can get a bottle for about $150.
But it's not any good.
Well, no, who's opened one?
And you're supposed to eat them with peanut butter and banana sandwiches.
You could.
Okay, so what's the price point that we're talking here about these newer bottles, these newer celebrity wines? I mean, how much are they going for?
I don't think I've seen anything higher than about $50.
Okay,
But, you know, I don't want to disparage them all because, like, one of the good lines is Greg Norman, the golfer. Mm-hmm. He's got an Australian line that I think is one of the better ones out there of these celebrity wines, certainly. Very nice, well-done wines. And then there are people who are the investors in wine. The Madonna's family is a good example. I mean, there's nothing to disparage about that because, you know, Tony Ciccone is a serious guy about wine. And he's had good winemakers, and they've been making some pretty decent wines. And in the run of Michigan wines, they're fairly up there.
Okay, overall. Final question. If you're going to buy one, let's say for a dinner party this weekend, if there's a bottle that you just had to get twisting your arm, maybe, what would you recommend?
I'd bring the Greg Norman, the Australian Syrah.
Chris Cook talks all things wine and food here on Stateside. He is the chief wine and restaurant critic at Our Detroit Magazine. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
In 2008, like so many college graduates, Ellen Knuth was looking for a job. But unlike many grads, Ellen found a job more than 6,000 miles away from her home in Michigan. She went to Japan to teach English. All her mother could do was hope and worry from afar.
I didn't know anything about Japan. I didn't know anyone who lived there. And so there was no advice I could give her, and there really wasn't anything for me to nag her about anymore. It was like, all I could do was listen. All I could say is, what's going on?
Jane Knuth now has Ellen back home in Michigan, and together they've written the new book, Love Will Steer Me True, A Mother and Daughter's Conversations on Life, Love, and God. Cynthia sat down with the authors earlier this week.
Jane, you and Ellen share your story, it seems to me, viewed through several filters. There's the parent watching a child begin to make her own way. There's the way that you discovered and learned from the Japanese culture and the traditions, and then the spiritual worries that you had as a Catholic mom, very, very worried her daughter might not continue her faith journey. Which of these was most important to you?
Well, at different times when she was there, over all 5 years. So this is all in her early 20s, and she's really gone very far away from me at a young age. And so I'm worried about all those at different times over those years. But when she first leaves and she tells me that there is no church in her town, and in fact, the nearest one is 2 hours by train, and that the Christian population of Japan is 1%, I'm like, that really struck me as she's so isolated. She's so away from a community of faith. And so that was where I was really didn't know how to deal with that.
And that's where lessons were certainly learned from what you saw and what Ellen experienced in Japan. Ellen, what were your biggest apprehensions and worries as you headed off on this big adventure? Or were you just so full of this excitement, I'm going, that you didn't think about it till you got there?
I think as a new graduate, I was worried about entering the working world. And so I was really much more focused on, I've got this job, but can I do it? I know I passed the rigorous testing and all of the interviews for the JET program, which is run through the consulate in Detroit. But I wasn't quite as convinced as the people who were hiring me that I was actually going to be able to teach English. So that was much more of a consuming concern for me than where am I going to say my morning prayers? That didn't really occur to me as a problem.
I'd like if I could ask you, Jane, to read us an excerpt from your book, Love Will Steer Me True. And this is the part where you and your husband, Dean, you're seeing Ellen off at Detroit Metro Airport. And this is where I'd say it's very clear that you are quite concerned for her spiritual well-being.
Yeah, we're all standing there and waiting for her to board. And so I'm thinking this to myself in the book. I'm thinking, Ellen Marie was born on August 15th, the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary into Heaven. It's one of those feasts that non-Catholic Christians find suspicious because of its scarce biblical foundations. The feast is based on 2,000 years of Catholic tradition passed from generation to generation. I am part of those generations, and I feel the obligation to pass on this truth. This is part of the issue between my generation and Ellen's. Now I pull the rosary out of my pocket, and I hand it to Ellen. I know you packed yours. Here, take this for the flight. This string of beads is what Catholics use to meditate on the events of Jesus' life through the eyes of his mother Mary. It's a symbol of what I really want to give my daughter, except God isn't giftable. God is not an object, nor is God an idea. God is a being. I can introduce these two to each other, but I can't start their conversation. Ellen pockets the beads and doesn't argue. She is kind-hearted. As soon as you can, find a church, okay? I tell her. We talked about this, Ma. That's not going to be possible. The coordinator of the program told me that the nearest Christian church is 2 hours away by bullet train. Remember? Still, there must be some kind of church in your town. There are always Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines, lots of them. Don't worry, I'll be fine. Two other families join us in the open space in front of the barriers. Ellen greets a young woman approximately her age whom we have met before. She's another eager Midwesterner who's seeking her future in the Far East. They both turn and wave happily to a young man who has one arm over the shoulders of his teary-eyed mother. I know how that mother feels. I will not look at her or I may end up the same sniffling mess. I will send my daughter out the door with faith. She will have my rosary, not my tears.
That's writer Jane Knuth of West Michigan as she reads an excerpt from the memoir she co-wrote with her daughter Ellen. The title, Love Will Steer Me True, A Mother and Daughter's Conversations on Life, Love, and God. Ellen, how did those worries your mom expressed strike you as you were trying to, you know, fly away?
Well, I think rationally, I knew they were coming from a place of love, but it really stressed me out because one of the whole reasons I was jumping at this chance to get this job and to move so far away was I really wanted to become that responsible adult that I knew my parents had put 20 plus years in raising me to be. So to have her again express her worries, even through the guise of prayer, made me feel like maybe this wasn't going to be possible for me to convince them that I was a fully capable tax-paying citizen. And that was all I was really aiming for. I think all a lot of 20-somethings are aiming for. So it added to the tensions.
I'm wondering what kinds of things began to happen and then continued to happen through your time in Japan that helped you to both see that you were both growing, not only in your mother and daughter relationship, but also spiritually.
The conversations we had were healing in some ways. There was some part of our relationship that kind of was not right before she left. It was this, she's trying to pull away, she's trying to be a grown-up. And so when she finally got there and settled in and she started telling us about the people she was meeting and the students she was teaching, and that was fun. That was nice. It was like, finally, she's someplace where she's happy. And people would say, are you worried about her over there? And I would say, well, I would rather she was there and happy than here and unhappy. So even though you hear my worries in the book, mm-hmm. it's mostly silent in my head worries. I didn't really pour them out all over the place.
Ellen, the excerpt I'd like you to share with us is when you headed up to the disaster zone to help in cleanup of a small fishing village that had been absolutely devastated, and lo and behold, it's your birthday. What birthday was this?
So this was my 26th birthday, I believe. And unfortunately, my birthday in Japan, though it isn't a religious day of observation, is the Day of the Dead. And so everything closes down. People are with their families. And so I just decided, since there wasn't much else to do, I would go and volunteer in the tsunami zone. The ocean stretches out black and calm, the moon reflected in a silvery trail that seems to reach for me. The only light comes from the building behind me and from the stars. The whole area is in complete darkness. Far away in the hills, I can see the shrine and the shine coming from the surviving parts of the town, the mountaintop housing areas. But the lowlands are blanketed in a blue-purple shadow. It's beautiful, I think, and then immediately feel horrible. Here I am, admiring the same ocean that killed thousands of people less than half a year before. I forgive myself for my thoughts. It's my birthday, after all. My birthday, August 15th, the Japanese Day of the Dead. When I planned the volunteer trip to encompass this personally important day, I justified my decision by reminding myself that there's not really anything else to do on this day. Japan shuts down. May as well put myself to good use. The waves lap gently at the rocks far below me, and I lean over the side of the rock pool to see them. I'm surprised to find the water full of flowers. Not just wildflowers, but beautiful bouquets, dozens of them, advancing and retreating with the tidal waters. They're not only directly below me, but all along the shore, as far as I can see. How odd, I think. And then the meaning hits me. Thousands are still missing from Minami-san-niku, and since the bodies haven't been found, must be presumed dead. During the Bone Festival, in which surviving family members are duty-bound to honor the deceased, the usual gathering spot is the graveyard, but those are gone too, washed out to sea. So these survivors, these bereaved, have no choice but to throw their offerings, with their love, into the ocean, hoping they will reach the resting place of their loved ones. It takes my breath away.
That's writer Ellen Knuth of Clinton Township reading an excerpt from the memoir she co-wrote with her mom, Jane. What do you each think were the biggest, maybe do's and don'ts, that you learned from your experience, both for parents and for kids? I'll let you start, Mom.
The biggest mistake I made, I think, was to always be worried. And my husband kind of pulled me away from that. He says, just stop worrying. And so I went into prayer instead, and I really improved my prayer life. You know, I lit candles and did novenas, and then I just didn't express my worries so much to her, and that made it easier for us to talk. She doesn't want to know what I'm worried about. That doesn't help her, you know. Yeah. It just does not help. She's got an adult viewpoint, and she knows where the problems are.
And it is her life.
Yeah, it's her life.
What about you from the daughter's perspective, Ellen, the do's and don'ts as someone's trying to journey, you know, far away from home?
Well, I think one of the things I wish I had realized earlier is that there is no perfect job, and that's okay. The fact that no one really cops to it when they're preparing you to enter into the workforce really surprised me once I actually realized it. And so I think I'm really grateful that I didn't wait around for that perfect job to find me, because then I would still be sitting on my parents' couch. And I think that was one of the most important things for me to keep in mind. The other would be that they tell us to be adventurous, and to be adventurous requires bravery, but you only have to be a little brave. Like, you don't have to go and completely save the world or completely change everything or start an orphanage or, like, completely, like, dig 5,000 wells or something. You just have to be the little bit of brave that it takes you to get on the plane or to accept that job on the other side of the world or to move even just across town. And that's all it requires. And that's what I didn't realize at first, was it's really just little bits of bravery that add up to making you courageous enough to take the bigger adventure.
We parents need to be a little brave, too.
Exactly. It works both ways. It's a lovely memoir, Love Will Steer Me, True, a Mother and Daughter's Conversations on Life, Love, and God, written by my guests, mother and daughter team of Jane and Ellen Knuth. It was a pleasure to meet you and talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Cindy speaking with the two authors. Jane and Ellen have three book signings coming up. You can find details at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. If you can believe it, it has already actually been a month since Election Day 2014. But Democrats here in Michigan, party leaders and strategists, are continuing to meet, trying to figure out just what happened to their party. It's fair to say it wasn't all bad for Democrats. Democrat Gray Peters, of course, he won the open U.S. Senate seat, and Democrats did win 7 out of 8 seats on higher education boards. But other than that, it was not too rosy. So let's try to figure out what's going on with Democrats here in Michigan. For that, we turn to the former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, chair for almost 20 years. Welcome, Mark Brewer.
Thank you.
And Joe DeSano, Democratic strategist in Michigan. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
So first off, let's just answer this question from both of your perspectives. Mark, I want to start with you. Is Michigan becoming a red state?
No, not at all. This is a very competitive two-party state. Whether you look at, as you indicated, the education board results, or you look at polling data and so forth, there are various message and mechanical problems, I would say, with how Democrats are performing in this state. But this is a very competitive state, and Democrats can do quite well.
And I want to get into that messaging and those issues. But, Joe, same question. Is Michigan getting redder? Is it a red state?
Oh, no. I think my opinion is very similar to Mark's in that we have mechanical problems. The party is beginning to do a postmortem on what exactly happened leading up to Election Day. There are message problems, but I also think there may have been targeting problems, and that will be revealed during the reverse engineering process.
So it seems to me that there's the issue of sort of mechanics of turnout, and then there's just one of messaging and whether Democrats did poorly with that. I mean, you're both Democrats, so you're going to say, hey, things aren't that bad. But we look at data, the top three statewide seats for governor, attorney general, secretary of state, control of both the state house and state senate. So Mark, speaking just particularly of mechanics, what went wrong?
Well, I think we know a lot of things already in terms of data. Look, both sides now are able to monitor the absentee voter process in this state on a daily basis because the Secretary of State requires the local clerks to post all that data, and it's accessible to everybody. So on a daily basis, you know, even weeks, months before the election, you could see what was happening with the absentee voters. And what happened here was, despite all this effort to get new voters, people who didn't vote in 210 to vote this time, in fact, in the end, about 90% of the absentee voters were people who would have voted anyway. And what happened was what I would call cannibalization, that in many instances, people who were going to vote on Election Day simply voted earlier. And so it was really not a success in terms of getting those 210 non-voters.
And this is a trend that we're seeing, that every election, midterm, and presidential, that more and more people are voting absentee.
It is a trend, but it's a slow trend. And Michigan is still an Election Day state. We're not a vote-by-mail state. We're not an absentee voter state. It is slowly increasing over time. But we're not a Colorado or a number of other states where this is a big deal, or Oregon, where it's entirely by mail.
And some of that is by rules in Michigan that you have to either be over 60, you have to go to the office and say, oh, I get one because I'm going to be out of the state. I'm not going to be able to make it to the polls. So you don't just get one.
Right. A part of it as well, though, is all this effort was made to solicit these absentee voters to get people who hadn't voted before to vote this time. But there's very little follow-up, and I'll just use my own example.
Please.
I had an absentee ballot in my hand for weeks. I got mine in early September, and I held it. I usually don't vote my absentee ballot till the week before the election. I got one contact from anybody on the Democratic progressive side of the aisle, and it was from a super PAC. So, again, while there's all this effort put into getting people to, send in their applications and get ballots, there seemed to me to be very little or ineffective follow-up. I think Democrats left a lot of absentee votes on the table, as they say, that end up not being voted by Election Day.
Well, I would say, Mark, in the voter file, which is what we use to select voters, I'm sure would be considered a top-of-the-line Democrat and perhaps would not require that follow-up due to his past voter history. He may have a point about some of the mechanics of following up and chasing the absentee ballots. I'm not sure using himself as an individual example.
You mean
is
just being
perhaps,
the former chair of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, you're fairly well known. I mean, maybe we can leave save the 49-cent postage and not send it to Mark. But hey, there very well may be a problem. In fact, I also think there could be a problem with targeting these drop-off voters that we are expecting to turn out. Maybe it is looking to target more moderate voters. Voters who may identify with Democrats who actually are higher income voters. That may be an emerging target that Democrats can look at to the next midterm election in 2018.
But Joe, wasn't that what we saw from both parties this past election, that it was a very get out the vote election, all about the base rather than independents, moderates for both parties? I mean, are you saying now that maybe there needs to be a change in strategy, that Democrats went too far trying to find their base and getting that turnout and should have gone to the center a little bit?
I don't know if I would ideologically call it the center. Mm-hmm. But I do think that both parties did view this as a base election. Mm-hmm. And I think in the postmortem that the Michigan Democratic Party is going through, I think those are some of the questions that are being answered. And you know what? Those are rather fair questions.
Joe DeSano, he is a strategist in Democratic politics here in Michigan, joining us, as well as the former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, Mark Brewer. So, Mark, we've been talking a little bit about strategy mechanics. Let's talk about messaging.
Well, I think this whole issue ties into what Joe just said. It's not a matter of changing the Democratic message. I think there are limits in terms of how much you can goose turnout in an off-year election. I think we've learned that. Mm-hmm. Everybody cites 2006, where we had 3.6 million voters. Well, that was a midterm. There was a wave against George Bush, and there was a wave against Dick DeVos that helped carry Governor Granholm to re-election. I don't think we're going to see that kind of turnout in a midterm. Mm-hmm. So Democrats need to realize that this is the electorate we've got. We can goose it a little bit, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But this is the electorate we've got, and we've got to talk to that electorate in a way that appeals to them. Message is not just about what you say. It's about whether it's believable, whether people think you can deliver what you say you're going to do. And I think we have a credibility problem. Our message is basically, we believe in economic empowerment, helping people economically, and we think government is one of the important tools to do that. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't believe that anymore. They say, show me where Democrats have done this, where they've delivered economic benefits to us here in Michigan or nationally. We have to come up with a message about a program that we can actually deliver on. I think message is more important than mechanics when it comes to turnout. People are motivated by a Barack Obama, a Jennifer Granholm. They're motivated by the message and the messenger much more than the mechanics. And we've got to get away from and have better balance of the mechanics and the message. We need a very powerful and effective economic message to folks. And that goes again to what Joe has been talking about. There's a good part of the electorate out there, particularly non-college voters in this state, but as well as nationally, that don't believe Democrats are on their side or can deliver for them economically. But we see a decline in the blue-collar vote for Democrats. And the white vote generally.
I was going to bring this up. There was this recent piece in the New York Times titled "The Demise of the White Democratic Voter," a former longtime political reporter talking about just that, that more and more whites are voting Republican, seeing that in Michigan. Joe, how do Democrats fix this?
Well, I think Mark has it right. You have to have a credible message to them. I think you have to address the problems they have in a manner that's believable. I mean, when I work with a candidate, I always tell them that the most valuable thing that you have in politics is authenticity. So your message has to be authentic, and the message deliverer needs to be authentic. In this case, I think Democrats actually had a really authentic person at the top of the ticket, Mark Schauer. I think our failing may have been we've targeted the wrong voters, and I think we've got to spend some time dealing with our white voter problem. And that article in the New York Times absolutely had it right. I mean, we're looking at, in some places, in many races across the country, at a rate of 30-40%, or sometimes less. That's something we need to address. I think it's part of building a big coalition and making those folks feel comfortable in the party.
So we're talking again about these two different issues, sort of the targeting voters, getting Democratic voters out to the polls, and then the messaging and the candidates. Let's start there with the latter. Mark, you talked about the names like Obama, Granholm. Anyone who meets those two, whether you believe in their politics or not, can't not talk about their charisma, right? The ability to get crowds excited. Do Democrats have a problem with their candidates here in Michigan?
No, not at all. Look, you can never build a political system or political party based on having charismatic candidates all the time. We've had some very non-charismatic people elected. Look, John Engler. No paragon of charisma, John Engler, but a very effective campaigner. Very effective at getting elected, obviously.
I would just look to our current governor.
Yes, our current governor as well. Joe's absolutely right.
Very fair.
So you can't always count on that. You can't wait for the charismatic person to come along. It helps, obviously, when you've got one, but you can't count on that. It's got to come back to message and program. And a lot of that, in this instance, was beyond Mark Schauer's control. A lot of that is national. Doesn't mean you can't do things in Michigan. I mean, for example, full disclosure here, I was the lawyer for this effort. Mm-hmm. There should have been a minimum wage proposal on the ballot. There could have been other things Democrats could have done that said, go to the polls, vote yourself a raise there in Michigan.
And we saw that nationally. Red states where there were minimum wage questions on the ballot, where Republicans, some did win, though, but those minimum wage ballots were approved.
There were six minimum wage and or paid leave proposals on the ballot. They all won. Several of them in very red states. Yeah. And it appears, even though the data is still here tentative, that it did goose turnout a little bit. Now, if we had had that here in Michigan, might have goose turnout enough to carry Mark Schauer?
I think Democrats need to be very careful not to run around in circles with their hair on fire. I mean, there were successes on Election Day. I mean, you know, Governor Snyder did receive 275,000 votes less than he did 4 years ago.
Sure.
And Mark Schauer received 182,000 votes more than our 2010 nominee. So I think you have to start with the success and not panic. But, you know, Mark makes a good point that there could have been efforts to goose turnout in different ways. And the minimum wage effort in particular may have goosed those downscale white voters that we may have to spend a lot of time talking to.
And yet, what does that say about Democrats in general? You know, there are more registered Democrats, of course, in Michigan. This is a fact. We know this. They don't turn out. It sort of reminds me, you know, you can have a really amazing football player, the best in the country, but if you can't actually get him to the field, it doesn't matter. So, I mean, is this a fundamental problem then with Democrats who just, it takes so much, including maybe ballot proposals, incredible candidates to get them to the polls?
No, I think it deals with the times. I mean, we are in a time, and I analogized to the Gilded Age in a tweet I did last week. I mean, look at the enormous economic inequalities in this country. Most people in this country believe, and this is not just blue-collar or white voters, they believe that the political and economic system is stacked against them. That's true of all demographic groups, all races. And that is reflected in people saying, why should I bother voting? Where's the program that's going to help me in my economic situation, educate my kids, help me get out of my minimum wage job or get a raise, get health care, whatever it may be? So it's not the problem with the Democrats or the voters. I mean, that was, I mean, going back to Roosevelt. Why did Roosevelt become so popular and build an enduring coalition? Because he delivered for the people of this country. He delivered an economic program which lifted the country out of the Depression.
So, Joe, are Democrats simply just not delivering right now?
No, I think Democrats actually are delivering here in the state. I think part of the problem is there are structural things placed into law by the Republicans, like, for example, the congressional districts. Democrats received the majority of votes for candidates for Congress in 2014. Yet, due to the gerrymandering, we only have a handful of seats. So, you know, Democrats are performing well across the state. And again, I'll go back to my previous comments. It's, we can't run around with our hair on fire. We have to identify what works and reverse engineer what doesn't work and fix it. There are structural problems, there are messaging problems, but all of it is fixable.
Well, let's talk about some fixes then.
Well, I think the first thing you do, and this is a fix that I think is not just applicable to Michigan, but everywhere, is I think you have to nationalize midterm elections. I would look at the 1994 contract with America that Newt Gingrich put forward. And what you do is create a nationwide echo chamber then of Democrats talking about poll-tested issues that resonate with voters. And that jives with what Mark was talking about as far as part of the problem of the mechanics is actually part of the messaging. I mean, this is all mixed up in a stew, and you've got to select the parts that work. And I do think that messaging is a large part of it. And I think Democrats need to take a national stand on populist issues. And then we can sell that here in Michigan quite well, because I think the electorate's ready to hear it if we say it with conviction and say it full-throated.
Well, I think we need, as I've talked about several times this morning, a real populist economic program that we can deliver on. And there has to be some elements of that, that even though we're in the minority in the legislature and don't control any statewide offices, that we can point to and deliver on. You've got to resolve redistricting in this state. And I think people of on all sides are seeing that there is a problem here. And it's not just at the congressional level. It's in the state legislature as well. Democrats took a majority of the votes for the state house but yet they end up with 47 seats.
Lost
Democrats
seats.
Took 49%, almost 50% of the state Senate vote.
And lost
but they
seat.
Have 11 seats in a 38-member. So that needs to be done. I really do think we need campaign finance reform and lobbying reform. I mean,
absolutely.
People do believe the system is stacked against them. You got to show how you're going to unstack the system in a way that will improve their individual lives.
So give me an example of something that didn't work this year in 2014 and how that would change in the next 2 years.
I personally probably would have done more messaging to women on choice issues.
Mark, you're sort of looking tentative about that. What would you say?
No, not tentative at all. I mean, that's a very, very important issue. I think we've got to reach deep and figure out an economic program. Senator Chuck Schumer has been talking about this in the last several days. I disagree with him in terms of he basically sounds like he's saying we should not have passed the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. He's wrong on that. But he's right in saying Democrats missed an opportunity when we controlled the Congress, both houses and the presidency, to not do more economically for the people of this country. And that would still be paying benefits today if we had done that.
Going back to the economy, Steve.
The economy.
Well, and Democrats have to be bolder. There is a tentative streak where Democrats feel that they have to present both sides of arguments. I'm sorry, Democrats listening, you don't. You have to present your argument persuasively, and I believe that a message that is populist would have been much more successful here in the state and in the future. So Democrats need to be bold, not tentative, and they should have embraced the Affordable Care Act.
Well, and there were some who said, look at Michigan as an example. You have Gary Peters, the only new freshman Democratic senator in the entire country, had President Obama come and campaign with him, whereas other senators going, no, don't come visit us. And there are some strategists who will say, no, absolutely, you should have talked up the president and National Democrats.
I would say this. You know, he's the only non-incumbent Democrat elected senator in 2014.
Democrats made a real mistake after passing the Affordable Care Act by basically running away from it for the last 4 years and letting the Republicans demagogue about what it's not. And that's a terrible situation. And it hurt us electorally this time. Democrats need to be bold. Too many times Republicans accuse us of class warfare. We didn't start the class warfare in this country. It's not Democrats' fault for pointing out the enormous income inequality in this country and how people are suffering economically in this country. We didn't initiate the class warfare. We've got to come up with an answer that helps the vast majority of these people in the country who have suffered because of that.
So an economic strategy and messaging. And then finally here in the last few moments, one of the things we were talking about, better targeting voters, the actual mechanics. Mark, let's start with you. How does that need to be fixed for Democrats and, you know, before the next 2 years, before the next election?
What? I think basically if you fine-tune some of the things that were done this time, look, this AV app that was put out, great idea.
The absentee voter.
Great idea. Wasn't ready for prime time. Had a lot of glitches, had a lot of problems in terms of people trying to use it and so forth. And that can appeal to a certain part of the electorate. I think you continue to work on trying to make it easier to vote absentee and so forth. But I come back to message. I think it's critically important that we have the right message. And that way, when you go door-to-door and you make a phone call and you reach out to people, it resonates with them and gives them a reason to vote. Simply contacting them and say, here's an absentee ballot, is not going to motivate them to vote. We've got to have a good economic program and a good economic message.
Mark Brewer, former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party for almost 20 years. In fact, you're the longest serving chair in the entire country, right?
At one time I was.
And Joe DeSano, Democratic strategist. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.